Lane bench. There's all kinds of excitement going on there.
Scores! Roll the highlight reel. 6-0 Flames.
You can put it in the wind column.
Yeah, baby! Yeah, baby! Yeah, baby!
This is Flames Talk with Pat Steinberg and Wes Gilbertson on Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
Okay, let's get things going this hour on the program. It is Thursday, May 8th. It's Steinberg and Wes along with you this hour. And welcome to the Sports Drive brought to you by Calgary Lock and Safe. The moving sale is on now. Save big on safes, smart locks, keypads, and more. Visit CalgaryLockandSafe.com. Yeah, it's Steinberg and Wes Gilbertson from Maxbell. We are here for the 2025 Centennial Cup. It is the best teams, best Junior A teams in all of Canada, all here at Maxbell this weekend beyond for the National Junior A Championship. All hosted by your AJHL champion at Calgary Canucks. More on that as we continue along this hour of Flames Talk on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, Seeker, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hello, Wes.
Hello, Pat.
Thanks for being along with us. And it is our pleasure now to go down the Atlas Pizza and Sports Bar guest hotline and say hello to our buddy Megan Mickelson, the color voice of the Flames, joins us now on the Atlas Pizza and Sports Bar guest hotline. It was Wednesdays with Mick, but it's different days of the week with Mick once a week because summer duties have taken over on Wednesdays for Mick. That's probably the best way of phrasing it, hey?
Yeah. We go from swimming to baseball every single Wednesday. So it's a full evening of activities for the kids and for Scott and I. So I appreciate you making the adjustment.
Hey, no problem. We're just happy to still have you on once a week. How are you, friend?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Getting ready actually to head down to the Centennial Cup. They're going to make an appearance for the opening game for the Calgary Canucks tonight, which I believe is at 7 p.m. So I'm pretty pumped.
When we will, of course, you've been part of the organizing committee of this Centennial Cup, and we will definitely get to that as we chat today. But there's no doubt what the biggest Flames news of the last few days has been, and that has been Matt Coronato's long-term extension. He signed it on Saturday, 7 years, $45.5 million, $6.5 million on the AAV. And Mick, like the response online, the text line, so on and so forth, has been nothing but positive when it comes to this. I mean, Flames fans are pretty excited that A, they got him locked up long term, B, that, you know, an American guy was willing to commit that much of his career to the Flames. I mean, there's a lot of excitement around it and a lot of excitement around the player coming off a 24 goal campaign this past year. So I guess I thought we would kick it off by, instead of talking about the contract, which we have talked about quite a bit over the last few days, like, What's next for Matt Coronato? He scores 24 as a rookie and showed such huge improvement one year to the next. Like, what are we expecting in the next year or two for this young man?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're not going to make me talk about the contract because as much as I understand it and I appreciate it and it's a great business move, I would much rather talk about the player and analyze that side of things. And you know, for me, it's pretty crazy to think of Matt Coronato at the beginning of this season, this past season, the guy that was sent down to the Wranglers early on to, you know, a guy who ends up scoring 24 goals for the Flames and finishing the season playing his best hockey of the entire year. He made so many strides, leaps and bounds in his game. And I think, you know, the biggest thing for me coming into the season was the speed that he was playing with. And I know he and I talked early on in the season, it was before the game in Montreal, just about how hard he worked on his skating and to become a faster, more powerful, and more efficient skater. And just how, you know, how much that had translated into his game. And, you know, I think that really showed in all areas. It helped him, you know, get to pucks faster. He was, you know, pretty relentless on the forecheck. You know, when you get to pucks first, you're obviously going to have the puck a lot more. So it helped with, you know, possession overall. And then, you know, getting himself into positions where he could get the puck to be able to use that lethal shot that he has. So, you know, know, I think that that was a big thing for me is, you know, seeing how much faster he was. I know that that was a message from Ryan Huska and the coaching staff at the end of this season. He wants all the players to get faster so they can play with more pace. So if Matt Coronato was able to get as much faster as he did last summer, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, the work that he can put in this summer as well and how that is going to translate into his game. If he can play with even more speed than he was playing with, you know, this season, I think it's only going to benefit his game even more. And then, you know, having a, you know, another full season in the league and, you know, just, you know, having that, I guess that confidence that comes with knowing like he's going to be there, he's going to stay there. There's not that uncertainty heading into the season. So, you know, I think it's going to allow him to have a much more productive summer, but I could honestly, I could see him scoring 35 goals next season. You know, I think that 40 would be exceeding expectations, but I don't think that 30 to 35 is, you know, out of the realm of possibility for him. And the other thing, though, to consider, I think, is it's always interesting when guys sign big contracts and what happens the year following that. So it's going to be interesting to see if he's one of those guys that elevates his game after signing a big deal or if it goes the other way. So I'm obviously hoping it's the former, not the latter. But there's so much potential there for him, and we definitely saw it this season.
Mick, what... And it certainly, you know, echoes what I feel is the same, that Matt Coronato could be a guy who could score 30 or 35 or maybe even more. But what gives you that optimism? What do you see in his game that makes him so dangerous and potentially such an important guy for a team that has struggled to produce offense?
Well, I think, like, for me, it was two things. One was the intensity and the drive that he plays with. Like, he's relentless, and he's a hound on pucks. So I think that work ethic and that mindset and that mentality, I think, you know, a player that's going to be great, you know, how you, I guess, layer that into your game, you have to figure that out. Like, a guy like Nathan MacKinnon, the way that he plays, that drive, intensity, work ethic, and how that benefits his game, that looks different than a guy like Matt Coronato. But figuring out how you layer that in to benefit your game, I think that's something that Matt Coronato he's really figured that out. And then, I mean, the other thing is the way that he elevated his game under pressure. Like, the season went along and they were more under the gun in terms of trying to make it to the playoffs and securing a spot, I thought he got better and better. So I think, you know, that's also a sign of a great player, that, you know, the higher the stakes, you know, the more that you elevate your game. So I think that we've seen that with him as well. But, I guess I would add one more thing, just the raw skills. Like, he's fast. He's not the biggest guy, but he's built like a brick you-know-what house. You've seen him off the ice in the dressing room. Like, he's a thick guy, and so he's really strong on pucks. You know, he's got the vision and the hockey IQ, and then he's got the shot to go along with it. So I think that all those things combined make him a very dangerous player with a lot of potential.
Yeah, it was, you know, Mick, it was one of those things. I'd be curious your perspective on it, because, you know, you watched Matt make the team, as we all did, but you know, we watched Matt make the team 2 years ago at a training camp, right? And he was the story of training camp 2023, and scored his first goal a couple games into his NHL career, but then things really started to fade. And remember, we were all up in Edmonton for the Heritage Classic, and we were kind of thinking to ourselves, geez, how much longer until they might think about going the American League route with Coronato? And it was only a couple days later, and he clearly wasn't ready that year to be a full-time NHLer. Fast forward to 1 year later, and he's scoring 24, and he's getting better as the year goes along. And I don't know, I just, like, I think the thing that surprised me the most is just how, and I had heard this and people had talked about this, but you kind of alluded to it, like, that work ethic and how much he puts into everything and how committed he is to making the improvements he needs to make. That was maybe the thing that impressed me the most.
Yeah, it was almost like when he came back up, at the beginning of the season, he had much more of a, like an FU mentality, you know, and it seemed to me anyways, like he was almost sick of sort of being in limbo, being up and down, and, you know, knowing that he full well had the potential to stay with the Flames, but, you know, just that the performance wasn't there. So, you know, I think that, you know, that's part of the journey, and that's part of, you know, a lot of guys' paths is, you know, making sure that you understand, you know, what it's going to take to stay at the NHL level. And, you know, that work ethic and that intensity that he plays with now, I think that that's a byproduct of him, you know, having had that experience of, you know, making the team and then going down and then coming up and going back down. So I think that, you know, that's a part of why he's been able to stay up and why he had the success he did this year is that work ethic, like you said.
I remember one of the interesting things we heard about Matt Coronato throughout the season was Ryan Huska saying, and I think it was after a practice, might have even been after a game, but he talked about how when Matt Coronato got sent down to the Wranglers for what will be his final stint in the AHL, they told him, hey, you know, don't worry about the game tonight. Just, you know, you can stay home and go to practice with the Wranglers tomorrow. And Ryan Huska said it told us a lot about his character that he showed up at the Wranglers game anyway, and he was in the locker room after the game. And I remember a couple of weeks later, I was talking to Matt Coronato in the locker room about something else, and I just asked him about that. And he looked at me like I had about six eyeballs. Yeah. And he just said, well, that was my team. Like, why wouldn't I have gone to the game? And that told me so much about him, because what he needed to do, and I think we all said a version of this when he came back up, what he needed to do was make it impossible on them to send him back. And that is what he finally did. But I don't think it was ever because, hey, I'm sick of the Wranglers, or I don't think I belong in the AHL. It was just a matter of getting those sort of feet under him as a pro, and you know, certainly doing some of the stuff he needed to do to improve his skating, and it's kind of been no looking back from there.
Yeah, and you know what else that tells you? Him showing up at the Wranglers game like that, like that's character, but that's also future potential as a real leader in this organization, because you know, that's what really solid teammates do, and that shows a ton of character and commitment. So I think that, you know, that's another thing to think about is, you know, he's a guy that could be a leader on this team and in a real hurry.
We're chatting with Megan Mickelson, the color voice of the Flames, joins us every week here on Flames Talk, joining us here on this Thursday. Another guy we talked a lot about this week, Mick, is Morgan Frost. And I remember how exciting it was when they acquired Morgan on that late January night, and we were all kind of keeping our eye on the internet as we were also watching the game the Flames were playing that night as that trade was being finalized, and it ends up being Frost and Joel Farabee coming to the Calgary Flames. And the excitement around Morgan Frost was that we're talking about a center iceman, a guy that is a natural center who's in that age range and can maybe be a center the Flames can grow with here over the next number of years. And yet the immediate returns in the 30 plus games that he played as a member of the Calgary Flames, maybe not as positive as a lot of people were hoping when that deal was made. So now that we've had a little time to reflect, friends, like how do we look at Morgan Frost's first few months as a member of the Calgary Flames?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one because obviously the results weren't there, you know, right off the start. I think that the biggest thing is for both he and Joel Farabee, they've come into the organization, a new organization, you know, for the first time. I think that they fit in really well with the team. So that's a real positive and something to, you know, consider and look at too, is how do you fit into the team dynamic? And obviously Morgan Frost was a guy that from all that we've heard has fit in really, really well. You know, in terms of his play, I think that there's a lot of positive signs. Like for me, I see the potential. I think that there was you know, a lot of games down the stretch there where he was really snake bitten. He was getting a ton of opportunities and they just weren't really going in for him. And I think, you know, he was also, to me, just overthinking things, you know, a little bit too much. But I think that the potential's there. Like, he handles the puck well, he shoots the puck well. He's a strong skater. As a centerman, he's good in the faceoff circle. He has the ability to transport the puck. So, you know, all of the tools are there. I do think that, you know, the defensive side of the game is an area that he needs to be better at. And in talking with him, that was something that he mentioned he was focusing on as well, as just being a better defensive player. So, you know, there was times where he would turn the puck over and you just think, oh gosh, you know, what are you doing type of thing. But, you know, it's a matter of kind of rounding out his game. And I think that, you know, what we saw from him was a guy who's trying to figure out how he needs to play on this team, like what his game looks like, the things that he needs to focus on that will allow him to be a good defensive centerman, but also put up the points at the other end of the ice. So I think that, you know, it was him trying to kind of figure things out a little bit. You know, it's unfortunate just kind of where he's at in contract situation wise, that it, you know, he had the end of to the season that he did. But for me, like, I see the potential and it's there. It's just a matter of finding his game. But I guess that's the challenge for any player at the NHL level, right?
It crosses me as not just a guy who's trying to figure out where he fits with the team, and certainly, Mick, that's a big part of it. I totally agree with you there. I think Morgan Frost, from my vantage point, is still sort of figuring out what he is at the NHL level. And, you know, I see a guy who arrived in Philadelphia as a first-round pick who had back-to-back 100 and some point seasons in the Ontario Hockey League, as a guy who probably thought he was going to put up numbers. And certainly you can see the offensive skill set there, especially on the power play. You can see how it could pop. And yet, you know, coming off a 37 point season and having never hit 50 in the NHL, I think sort of the time is now for Morgan Frost to realize, hey, I'm not good enough offensively to not become a better defensive player. I'm not so good offensively that I'm going to get any sort of pass on Ryan Huska's insistence that I'm harder on pucks. And that's where I'm really fascinated to see where Morgan Frost's game goes, because I think he's such a smart guy. I think he's a really cerebral guy. And if the sooner he realizes that there's just got to be a little bit different level of dig in on some of that, those other parts of the game, because that's going to make him more well-rounded, and that's going to make him a guy mm-hmm. who plays 700 or 800 or 900 games in the NHL. I think, like, we're in a kind of sooner is better scenario there, at least the way I see it.
Yeah.
I think though that he knows that. Like, I talked to him, it was the last home game of the season at the Saddle Dome, and it was, you know, a time where I think it was right before the game against Vegas, actually. And he, you know, I said to him, I'm like, are you going to go crazy if you don't score a goal here pretty soon? And he was like, yeah, I think I've actually already gone a little bit crazy. But then he said to me, but you know what? I'm focused right now. I'm focused on improving the defensive side of my game and making sure that, you know, I'm playing the right way. And, you know, that's something we heard from the guys all season long and from Ryan Huska, playing the right way. And so to me, like, he, in saying that to me, he knows that he needs to be better defensively. He knows that he can't turn the puck over. So, I mean, I imagine that that's been a message that's come from the coaching staff already, and something that he's going to look at, you know, improving in a hurry.
Well, and I, Mick, I look at the things that he brings to the table. I mean, I think he's their best entry guy when it comes to the power play. I think that's one of his real strengths is being able to enter the offensive zone and do so with possession and get things set up. And both 5-on-5 and on the power play, he's good there. We know he's got some good skill. He's got a decent enough shot that he doesn't maybe use as much as that's been one of the things that people have said is like, hey, if this guy uses his shot a little bit more, we could be talking about a little more offense. I guess for me, and I know that this might sound like excuse making, but you're the former player. This guy came from a place where he was pretty beaten down mentally, as did Joel Farabee, by what was happening in Philadelphia and being somewhat on different pages with then head coach John Tortorella. And you go from that, and I think that took a toll on both guys. And then you get traded. You weren't necessarily expecting to be traded in the middle of a game. And now you're in a brand new city, you're in a brand new city and with new surroundings and new teammates. And I know that there is definitely some excuse making in there. And yet I also think that it's legit for both players that, you know, I want to see what a full training camp and being set where your feet are without all of the craziness that goes into a trade and having some of that time in Philadelphia far further behind you. I want to see how all of that combines to maybe be better in a first full season for Frost next year.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, I don't think those are excuses. I think that, you know, you look at both players and they both have a lot of potential. So you're just kind of trying to figure out why they're not playing up to their potential. And those are very valid reasons, in my opinion. But, you know, I'm on the same page. Like, they know they're going to, or hopefully they're going to be showing up to training camp and they're going to, you know, be the guys that they know that they can be. They'll feel much more comfortable in their surroundings and in the situations that they're in. And that will, you know, allow them to perform at the level that they need to. So, you know, I think that we have to remember that, you know, yes, they're professional hockey players and you can't give them excuses, but at the end of the day, like, they're people too. They're human beings. And I think, like you said, they both come from an organization where things really weren't easy on them. So to come to Calgary and to try to adapt really quickly, you know, different systems, all the things, right? There's so many adjustments that you're making. I think that, you know, I look at both guys and at the end of the day, I see a lot of potential and that they just, you know, need a little bit more time to adapt to a new team.
Mick, before we let you go, we have to ask you about this 2025 Centennial Cup, which is now officially underway. As we're sitting here talking, one game done, another game is underway. You've been a part of the organizing committee for the Centennial Cup for quite some time, and I know you'll be down here a little bit later on Thursday for the Calgary Canucks when they open up their tournament as the AJHL champions. Just tell us about how excited you are to have the Centennial Cup in Calgary.
Oh yeah, I'm really, really excited. And I think, you know, having seen, you know, Sandy Edmondstone and Lyle Petterman, I have to give Lyle a massive, massive shout out, because this guy wears probably 20 different hats, including being a co-chair of the host organizing committee, but just the amount of things that he has done, you know, to get this thing up and running and the work that he does every single day behind the scenes. The Centennial Cup in Calgary literally would not be happening without Lyle and without Sandy as well. So I'm excited to watch and to see it all kind of come to fruition, but also to see how the Canucks do. I know, you know, I said to Sandy earlier this morning, I said, you know, hopefully the Canucks do really well and, you know, they'll be in the final and, you know, we can all celebrate. And he said to me, hope is not a strategy, that this team is built to win this tournament. So I'm curious to see how the Calgary Canucks end up doing, just with the amount of work they put into building a really strong team, too. So hopefully there's a good turnout and lots of people want to come out and watch the games, too.
And it's always pretty neat when your city can host 9 different teams, and it's a national championship. All things considered, it's pretty neat to have that here in Calgary. Enjoy the game as the Calgary Canucks open up on Thursday night. Enjoy it, Mick, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you as always, friend.
All right, thanks, guys. Have a good one.
Megan Mickelson is the color voice of the Calgary Flames. She joins us every week here on Flames Talk, and she joins us on the Atlas Pizza and Sports Bar guest hotline. Serving the best pizza, pasta, steaks, and ribs for over half a century. Dine in at 6060 Memorial Drive Northeast, or call 403-248-3344 for pickup or delivery.
Anything and everything Calgary Flames. It's all on Flames Talk. Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
It's Pat Steinberg and Wes Gilbertson along with you on this Thursday edition of the program. And it's time to say hello to our regular Thursday guest. He is our goaltending expert. Kevin Woodley joins us now from In Goal Magazine and NHL.com. We got lots to get into with Mr. Woodley on this Thursday. Hello, Kev. Happy Thursday. How are you, friend?
I'm good. I'm enjoying a little Stanley Cup playoff action. I know both of our cities would prefer to still be involved, but, you know, sometimes it's a little less stressful from the couch.
It definitely is a little less stressful, less writing on deadline for guys like you and Wes. So that definitely makes
sense. I bet you Wes had a little bit of, like, cringy moments as I did, you know, like with teams up 3-1. Some of the comebacks we've seen so far.
Yeah,
I enjoyed them from my couch, and I absolutely cringed for whoever was doing it on deadline.
The the saving grace in the playoffs is you get that 18-minute intermission before overtime. So if a team ties it up with about 2.1 seconds left on the clock, you at least have a little bit of time to watch a replay and remember what rink you're sitting in. But yeah. There's been some tough ones.
Except for the old days. I remember I covered the Cup Final in 04 in Calgary, the Calgary end of it, and then again in Edmonton in 06 for USA Today. But that was, like real newspapers, as Wes, actually sometimes have deadlines that where you're filing running copy at the buzzer, even if it is going to overtime. So, man, it's a lot harder in those moments than people realize. Not that I'm complaining. I love my job. But, man, some of those moments can be, like, tough.
Sometimes when a team scores with 5 seconds left and you just reach to take a sip of your beer, that's fine too, hey?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. I just salute those that aren't sipping beer and are sweating. I can imagine the words that are being said in the press box at the time.
I mean, Wes drinks beer when he's working, so.
If they'd let me.
Yeah, we were born in the wrong generation, Wes. There was definitely beer in the press box in the 70s, my friend.
Yeah, the cigarettes and the beer. It was a different time. Kev, here in Calgary, it wasn't a massive surprise for Flames fans, but Monday during the NHL draft lottery, it was announced that Dustin Wolf, along with Macklin Celebrini and Lane Hutson, is a Calder Trophy finalist, and it is definitely one of those things that Flames fans were looking forward to and waiting for, but also a really deserving accomplishment for Dustin after a stellar rookie campaign as a 23-year-old, hey?
Yeah, absolutely. And listen, I don't know where this comes out. And I've told you guys before, I find it hard enough sometimes to compare, especially without the stats I have access to through ClearSight Analytics. I have trouble comparing one goalie to another, sometimes even on the same team. And we can get to that in the case of the Oilers in a minute. But to compare, goaltenders to defensemen and forwards, I don't know where this comes out. But to be nominated, I think he deserves to win it. I think what he's done as his first year in the NHL is remarkable. There are very few that have this level of success. So I'm curious to see how this voting plays out. I fear, for Flames fans and for Wolf, that the playoffs will somehow be a deciding factor, and the fact that Hudson's team got there and his didn't, maybe that affects some people's opinion and voting. Because what Lane Hutson did as a defenseman is also remarkable. So you tip your cap to a generation we're going to get to watch for a long time, all three of those guys, and they're all exciting in different ways. The other vote that I'm actually almost more curious to see, because it is more apples to apples to a certain degree, is I want to see how many Vezina votes he got. Because if there aren't some, And you know, I think we know who wins it. And obviously we know who the finalists are, with Vasilevsky, Hellebuck likely to win, Vasilevsky and Kemper all deserving. I'm hoping to see some votes. And I can't remember if the GMs just vote 1, 2, 3, or if they got to go 1 through 5. Because Dustin Wolf would be, you know, he'd be my four. He'd be up there. Actually, he'd probably be on my ballot ahead of Vasilevsky, to be honest. So I would certainly like to think that the GMs see it the same way. And if not in the top three, and obviously not a finalist on enough of them, that he's at least on enough of those ballots to see where he plays out in the voting, because he should have got some.
Yeah. No, it's very, very cool to see, and I'm with you. I hope he gets some Vezina Trophy love from the general managers when it's all said and done, and we'll find that out, obviously, once the awards are given out. Let's move from that to, and we'll talk about the Oilers. We'll talk about the Hellebuck situation in Winnipeg, but maybe the biggest goaltending controversy this week has been in Toronto after Sam Bennett and his collision with Anthony Stolarz in game one between the Maple Leafs and Florida. Joe Wall got the start in game two on Wednesday night. The Maple Leafs have a 2-0 series lead. Kev, you've got your goalie union card, but where do you come out on that collision with Bennett and Stolarz back on Monday night?
I mean, I don't want to say innocuous, because I don't want to dismiss it. It didn't look obviously as bad as it ended up being. But at the same time, I struggle even in the moment to not see him lean into it. Is there a chicken wing? No. Is there a ton of pace to it? No. But at the end of the day, he appears to steer into it enough to me that I'm sorry. Like, I don't know how that's not deliberate. And, you know, this is maybe a conversation in the heat of the, you know, and everything that Sam Bennett has been around in the playoffs, maybe it's too heated around him, but the bigger conversation is, and I might not even have an answer here, but I'm surprised we don't see more of this. The goalie mask is designed to protect you from puck impact coming at you from a forward position. It's really not designed for side impacts. It's not designed for you to get hit like that. And, you know, I mean, obviously anybody getting hit in the head runs risks, but the way it pulls the head and the neck around is problematic. And, you know, there are a couple of companies that are taking steps. There are two different CCM models. One I'm wearing, because I have, you know, full disclosure, I have a long history of concussions. I have had that moment where I've been clipped on the side of the head by a knee or a hip of someone skating through the crease while I'm in the butterfly. And it's usually 10 to 15 minutes later throwing up on the ice. And sometimes it's some sacrocranial therapy with, actually, interestingly enough, Jordan Siglett's brother, Stefan, is a chiropractor here that does that stuff and has, you know, like a wall full of NHL jerseys hanging with messages saying, thanks for, you know, I don't know what you did, but thanks for saving my career. He's renowned in this department and a lot of people seek him out, and he's been a lifesaver for me. Sometimes it's as simple a visit to him the next morning and it's more of a whiplash thing and everything is fine. Sometimes, you know, more concussion like symptoms last. So I hope in Stoller's case that they're able to get the right treatment and that this is very short term. But at the end of the day, we're often on our knees and bodies are flying through with the potential to just even graze you at the right angle, and it pulls your head in a direction that isn't healthy, and it creates these whiplash effects that can create concussion symptoms. I don't know how you fix it. Like I said, there are a couple different masks that have, there's one with fluid pods in it developed in conjunction with a concussion program at the University of Ottawa, and the fluid pods are what make the most direct contact in 4 or 5 different points with the head. And so when the mask gets hit from the side, there's a certain amount of give that the mask has laterally before it starts to take your head with it. So there are things that you can do, but almost, you know, only a handful of goalies wear it. Everybody wears a more traditional old school foam mask like Anthony had, and it still protects you forward impact on pucks, but not as much on this impact. So maybe there's some education needed on the goalie side. I don't know how you fix the side impact stuff, but avoiding it would be a good idea. And at the end of the day, it was pretty clear that rather than avoid it, he leaned into it. That's how I saw it.
Yeah. Okay, so now it's Joe Wall. He picks up the win in game two. How much of a gap are we talking about, Kev, or how much of a step back or step down for the Maple Leafs are we talking going from Stolarz to Wall?
You know, I think it's only in the ceiling, and it's not absolute. And I say that because Joseph Wall is a guy that I'm big on. So full disclosure, I said last year he would be their guy moving forward. Like, they had their starter. There was a bunch of questions midway through the season, and I'm like, I don't know what the questions are. Joseph Wall's the guy, and I think he's going to be for a long time. And he's had that level of success. You know, you saw what he did last year. He steps into the playoffs, and until the injury, like, performed really well. It's been a little less consistent this year. He's played more than ever, and getting through a season healthy was important, but the numbers dropped off a little bit. And so, you know, they both have high floors is how I would put it. They're both really technically sound. Stolarz is massive. Stolarz this year has had a higher ceiling, and that's where the drop off might exist. Now, he hadn't played to that in the first round. Ottawa didn't test him. His adjusted numbers were below expected. But at the start of the year, before he had the knee surgery, Stolarz was playing at a Vezina level clip. Now, he was way more inconsistent coming back from the knee surgery, but in the week to 10 days leading up to the playoffs, it looked like he found that gear. And so him at that gear is higher than we've seen Wall perform overall and higher than we've seen him perform on bulk this year. But there's not a drop-off in terms of floor, of not making mistakes, of not giving up bad goals, of not hurting you. And to be honest, the way the Leafs are defending right now kind of echoes a little bit what's going on in Edmonton. That might be all you need. Now, I watched the game really closely last night, and I thought it was one of the better ones that Wall had played. Like, he looked like the guy that I've always written, like, the foundation was there, but he looked a little more fluid last night than he has at other points this season. To me, I know he made some changes in his training, and he seemed a little rigid with it and rigid in his movements, almost like he was, you know, trying to hold certain positions rather than just playing. I thought last night was a perfect blend of sort of old and new. And if you can find that guy on a regular basis going forward, you know, maybe they don't, I don't want to say maybe they don't miss Anthony Stolarz, because again, the ceiling is there. But, you know, maybe it's not as impactful. And at the end of the day, they were a team, I said going in, and Craig Berube, the head coach, is one who wants a number one. But they were a team I thought would need two anyways and would be smart to use both. Maybe it's forced upon them, and we see a situation like we did in Pittsburgh during the two straight cup runs where both guys played a role. Yeah. You know, interesting that nobody wants to choose that path, and yet we've had so many cup winners where it's chosen for them, and it helps them get to the finish line.
We're chatting with our buddy Kevin Woodley. He is our goaltending expert from In Goal Magazine and NHL.com. Joins us on Thursdays here on Flames Talk. Joining us right now with Pat and Wes, Mr. Gilbertson.
Kevin, the extent of my goaltending knowledge would lead me to believe that if you're 5-0 as a playoff starter, that's pretty good. And so I'm curious, as someone who's breadth of knowledge on the position goes a lot deeper, what are you seeing from the Edmonton Oilers' sudden number one?
Yeah, it's really interesting, right? Like, if you want to just do the numbers, you know, relative to environment and relative to expected, the truth is, I mean, he's played better than Skinner, no question. That was a tough start for Stewart, but he's still, you know, in the playoffs so far this year, below what an NHL average goalie is expected to stop facing the quality of shots he has. And so, but he's winning. And so you look for, you know, trends within that. And there are some key differences here. One, first of all, and I think we talked about this a little bit last week, the environment changes when he's in net. They defend, and whether this is a coincidence or not, Knobloch's hinted at it, talked about it openly, actually, in the first round. For some reason, they defend better when Calvin Pickard's in net, and that holds true. Skinner's save percentage expected, the environment he faced was an 872, and Pickard's was as high as 914 heading into game six of the first round. It's down around 900 right now, but that's still a 30-point differential. The biggest difference in terms of performance, where Calvin's numbers and sort of adjusted numbers get hit, is on some of the mid and low danger chances that he's given up. But on high danger stuff, he has been notably better. Skinner in those first two games was 9 high danger goals on 19 chances. And Pickard right now is up to 15 goals on high danger chances. Sorry, not that much. Got to click a button. He's up to 8 high danger goals, but on 35 chances. And on his first 19, which he saw 19 high danger in his first 3 games in the first round, he had given up 3 compared to Stewart's 9 on 19. So, in other words, timely saves are a real thing. And when you come up with the tough ones in big moments, and Pickard has been through a lot to get in this spot, a lot of experience, he's been able so far to sort of rise to those moments and make those big saves. I mean, you know, it looked like the game was over anyways, but when the Kings mounted that late charge in game 6, like that backdoor pad save that he made, you know, in full extension off the right post, like that was highlight reel. That was remarkable reactionary elements. He is exceptional at reading and processing the game, which you'd expect from a guy at his size that has lasted this long. The interesting part of this Vegas series will be, especially when they get Pietrangelo back, and assuming they do tonight, having not looked at sort of updates today, do they work the points more? Because for all those high danger saves he's making, traffic has been a statistical weakness, regular season and playoffs. Like if you can create chaos in front of them, and again, you know, to a certain degree, not the same, but Connor Hellebuck, right? Like reads the game exceptionally well. So take away his eyes. Mm-hmm. Calvin's numbers on screen chances are really not, that's one of the areas he struggled the most statistically. And yet I think a lot of teams look at him in a pre-scout and be like, oh, we can do this, we can do that, let's beat him this way. And they don't want to simplify the game because they think they can score pretty goals, and the numbers suggest maybe you should go the other way. And I'm curious to see whether Vegas figures that out before it's too late.
Kevin, one more for you here, and without getting into the maybe what if game, or maybe we can't avoid the what if game a little bit, but how significant was that comeback for Connor Hellebuck? Like how significant or how crucial for Connor and for his mindset and maybe for his legacy even was getting out of the first round in one piece?
Yeah, I mean, certainly from a narrative perspective, Wes, like it's massive. Beyond that, you know, I don't know that the story's been written, right? We'll have to see what happens against Dallas. But I will say, I thought he looked a lot cleaner and a lot more confident last night, even though they lost. Okay. I also thought the game in front of him looked a lot less chaotic. And, you know, maybe there's a horses for courses element here. Much like Colorado the year before, St. Louis is fast. Man, they play fast. And they created a ton of chaos. And his game is so read-based that they might have been just one of the worst options to face. Now, Dallas statistically excels at creating screen opportunities and creating broken play goals, two of the areas where Connor has struggled statistically relative to everything else he does so well. I mean, he's still above expected. He's Connor Hellebuck, but relative to those things, that's where teams have nailed him in the playoffs. You know, we saw a deflection. We saw an own goal, a broken play off a defenseman the other night. But I just thought the game in front of him looked more predictable, and no one predicts that type of environment better than Hellebuck. And I thought he looked in so much more control last night than in large portions of the St. Louis series. So maybe getting through is enough for him to get back to the things that he does well and to really trust them and trust what everyone is doing in front of him. But again, I want to see what happens with this series. We know what he's capable of. We know how good he is. He's going straight to the Hall of Fame, guys. He's about to win his third Vezina, second in a row. But, you know, can he hold up if it gets more chaotic? That's what makes the playoffs so tough for a goaltender. The book gets written and teams go to it to the nth degree. And I'm curious to see whether that environment changes. I thought last night, again, it's a loss, but I would have come away from that game feeling really good about how he looked if I'm the Winnipeg Jets and their fan base.
Great stuff as always, Kev, as we move into next week's chat. We didn't even touch on the Freddie Anderson contract, which I think we still should, and the UFA market for goalies. So there's still plenty to get to as we move throughout, and obviously lots of Stanley Cup playoff action to get to as well. Thanks as always for doing this. We'll talk to you again next week, hey?
Thanks, guys. Enjoy the weekend. Enjoy the hockey.
You as well. He is Kevin Woodley. He's our goaltending expert from In Goal Magazine and NHL.com. He joins us on the Atlas Pizza and Sports Bar guest hotline, serving the best pizza, pasta, steaks, and ribs for over half a century. Dine in at 6060 Memorial Drive Northeast or call 403-248-3344 for pickup or delivery. As we start to wrap things up this hour on Flames Talk, Wes Gilbertson on Twitter at Wes Gilbertson. One more reminder, get yourself to Max Bell here all week, in fact, all the way up until May 18th when the 2025 Centennial Cup wraps up. Calgary and the Calgary Canucks hosting Canada's National Junior A Championship here in Calgary all week and heading into next week. That wraps up our hour. That wraps things up from Max Bell. That wraps up the Sports Drive brought to you by Calgary Lock and Safe. The moving sale's on now. Save big on safes, smart locks, keypads, and more. Visit CalgaryLockAndSafe.com.